Lecture 34, Dynasty 20, The Decline Continues.
Hi, welcome back. Remember last time we talked about the 19th dynasty, and we saw it declining from the great years of Ramses down to a woman, Tausert, ruling Egypt. The decline continues in the next dynasty, and I want to talk about that dynasty, Dynasty 20. There are going to be some interesting things here. We're going to see a mysterious people trying to invade Egypt, the Sea Peoples. And we'll see Egypt weakening, and we'll also look at the reign of one pharaoh carefully, Ramses III, to see what indications there are of this decline. But let's start with the first pharaoh, Setnacht. His name? It means something, as you've gathered by now. Set is the god, Set. Nacht means mighty or victorious. So his name has something like Set as victorious or Set as mighty. He's a mystery king. I can hardly tell you anything about him. The one thing I can tell you is that as soon as he becomes king, he erases Tausert's name from her tomb in the Valley of the Kings. She is the queen who rules and then is erased as quickly as it happened. A sign that there was turmoil. Now, Setnacht has this tomb in the Valley of the Kings. We know that. There's only one other source that we really find out about him from. It's the papyrus Harris. And it's a curious story about this papyrus. Now, papyri, as you know, are named after the people who discover them or own them. Right? So Harris owned this thing. It's a papyrus that is written during the reign of the next pharaoh, Ramses III, Ramses Meriamun. He's going to be the next pharaoh. And it was supposed to be buried with Ramses III. It's a history of his reign. But it turned up in a private person's tomb, in a commoner's tomb. Now, how does a royal papyrus, the archive of Ramses III, turn up in the tomb of a commoner? I'll give you my theory. Just a theory, but I think it's a good bet. Ramses III is buried in his tomb in the Valley of the Kings, and we'll get to that. Buried in the tomb with his papyrus, the archive of his reign. That tomb is robbed sometime later. The papyrus is stolen. Now, the papyrus has no intrinsic value. It's paper, basically. But the robber figures out a way to sell it. Now, remember that most people in Egypt are illiterate. Very few can read, only scribes. And the robber probably doesn't know what this thing says, even. So he figures out, I'll sell it as a book of the dead. Now, many wealthy Egyptians were buried with books of the dead. These are papyri intended to help your journey to the next world, to assure that you'll make it successfully. So it's sold. This record, this administrative record, is sold to somebody. Here's a book of the dead. You can be buried with this thing. And somebody went to the next world thinking he had a book of the dead, but he really had administrative records of Ramses III. But this papyrus is a clue to Setnacht's reign. Ramses III records his reign, but he says, the previous pharaoh, Setnacht, right? Probably dad, whom he's glorifying, right? Repulsed the Asiatics who had tried to enter Egypt, right? Says he restored the order. So at least Ramses III is saying, Setnacht did pretty good stuff. He took over when things were rough. Remember, a queen ended the previous dynasty ruling. Took over and got things on track. So at least in this papyrus it says Setnacht was pretty good. Otherwise, I can't tell you much about this mystery king. But now we get Ramses III. And for him, we've got lots of stories. Now, I think in some sense, Ramses III is the last great pharaoh of Egypt. He does great things. And let's talk about those things. First, the Libyans tried to invade Egypt. Ramses III repulses them, crushes them, right? That's about the fifth year of his reign, so he's not ruling very long, and he's got this battle, but he does it. And then he talks about the Sea Peoples. Now, they're just called the Sea Peoples. They seem to be a confederation of Mediterranean people, Mediterranean types, right? They're probably Philistines, even people perhaps from the area of Sicily, right? And it looks like they were having hard times in their own lands because they're emigrating. They're trying to come into Egypt. And we have scenes of them carved on walls. And they have ox carts, large carts drawn by oxen. and they're piled high with their possessions. And you see women and children coming along. So this is not just a military invasion. This is a real immigration. It's like maybe the United States at the beginning of the century, when hard times, people want to come in. Now, Ramses III views it certainly as an invasion. There were military people with them, right? And there are two major battles that he fights against these sea peoples. The first is on land, towards the delta. Remember, the delta is that moist area of Egypt. Look at it as a hand. Imagine it as a hand. The Nile flows from south to north, and then at the end of it you have a hand with different branches of the Nile, where the Nile spreads out and flows into the Mediterranean. So on one of those branches, he keeps out the sea people. So he fights them on land. Well and good. But then there's a battle on sea. Now, sea is really, I say it in quotes. It's in the delta on one of the branches of the Nile. So it's really almost a landlocked battle. And that's fortunate for the Egyptians, very fortunate. Remember, they were not good sailors. They were spoiled by the Nile. It was so easy to sail the Nile that they really never learned difficult maneuvers. For example, if you were sailing from south to north, the way the current goes, you just went with the current. You had some oars for steering, but you didn't have to propel your boat. If you were going from north to south against the current, well, there's a prevailing wind at your back. You put up your sails and you go. So they never had to do the really difficult stuff like tacking or learning navigation. So they weren't good sailors. So when it comes to the battle at sea, they were lucky. They didn't have to maneuver. It's on this little area. Basically, they were fighting a land battle from ships. And the scenes of it that Ramses carved shows that. You have archers. They're on deck of a ship shooting arrows at the other guys, the bad guys, who are pretty close to them. You even see guys jumping ship from one to another. So this is a land battle fought on ships. And of course, as you know, the Egyptians are always victorious. So the people of the sea are repelled. Now, this Papyrus Harris that I told you about, it tells about Ramses' achievements. And they were many. He really was a great pharaoh. First of all, it lists all the gifts that he gave to the temples of Egypt. Now, this is important. One of the things the pharaoh did, it was a kind of business agreement between the king and the gods, was when you went out in battle and you were successful, you brought back booty and you donated a lot of it to the temples because the gods had looked upon favorably with your battle. So Ramses lists all of the gifts he gave to the temple, and it's an immense quantity of oils, priests needed oils, linen, priests wore white linen only, right? Linens. Land. Land is crucial. By the end of this dynasty, the Temple of Amun at Thebes is going to own 90% of all the temple lands in Egypt. It's a vast tract of land. And they didn't own just the land. They had the cattle, the produce, everything. And Papyrus Harris lists all of this. So we can see that Ramses is living during an economic boom, powerful, giving to the temples and getting back. He's conquering foreign lands. So Papyrus Harris is important. It's an important source. Also, he lists his military campaigns, all of them successful, of course. And we know from this papyrus that Egypt is really booming. I mean, it's a troop. It gives you an accurate picture. He's really doing fine. Now, what happens during his reign is really curious. There are certain signs of decline. But first, let's look at the high point, his temple, right? He builds a temple called Medina Habu. Now, that's the modern Arabic name for it, right? It's really called United with Eternity. This is a mortuary temple. Ramses is going to be united with eternity. Now, remember what a mortuary temple is. It's a place where the pharaoh is going to be worshipped after his death. We are going to have priests forever. Bringing food, beer, bread, to the temple for the soul of Ramses. And the way Ramses assures it is he gives land to the temple, and forever the produce of that land will sort of be an endowment for his mortuary temple. Now, the mortuary temple is unique. It's huge, first of all. I mean, it is huge. The walls are 30 feet thick, built out of stone, not mud brick. Temples had to last forever. Palaces, houses, just a generation, they were built out of mud brick. Temples, tombs, out of stone. It's huge. But it had three functions, not just the mortuary temple. If you look at the entranceway to Medina Habu, you will see that it's in the shape of a Syrian fortress. It's very much like a Syrian fortress. Ramses obviously thought that at some point he was going to have to defend Egypt, in the south even maybe, where the temple is, in Thebes, on the western bank. Remember, he's kicked out Libyans, he's kicked out the sea peoples. He's seen it all happen. So he builds his mortuary temple to have a double function, as a fortress. There are places on the top where archers could stand, behind crenellations, those little bumps, you know, and shoot their arrows. So first, it's the only mortuary temple we have that looks like a fort. Another function, it was a palace. Ramses actually lived there, but not permanently. He's ruling from the north, capital's in the north. He lived there when there were religious festivals. He would come south for the festival of Opet. Now, that was the greatest festival in Egypt at the time. It's when the statues of the gods, Amun, Mut, and Khons, the trinity of Thebes, were taken out and brought from Karnak Temple about a mile and a half away to Luxor Temple. And they would stay there for a fortnight. And during that time, there would be feasting and all kinds of partying. And he would come for that festival. And where would he stay? He's not going to stay at a hotel, right? He had his own palace built. And it's interesting to walk the palace. One of the things that amazes people when they walk the palace of Ramses III, a great king of Egypt, is how small it is. There are no great rooms. And the reason is, there's nothing architecturally that enabled you to build a room in those days. You can't have a large piece of stone spanning a roof. There was no way to support a large open area. So it's really a cramped area. And when you look at Ramses' bathroom, it's practically camping out. I mean, it's like a latrine. But that was the room that Ramses the Great used. That's the room that Ramses III is going to use. It's typical king bathroom, but it's not very impressive. But this is a palace. It's a fortress. And it's the mortuary temple of Ramses. Now, Ramses, during his lifetime, had some of his sons die also, just like Ramses the Great, remember? But one of the things we have to keep clear, Ramses III is the 20th dynasty. Ramses the Great is the 19th dynasty. They are not related in any way whatsoever. Ramses III has chosen his name because he wants to hearken back to the days when Ramses the Great was ruling. So he kind of wants association by name, you know. And he does it doubly. He buried some of his children too. He reigned for about 30 years. And he buried some of his children. And two of the children whom he buries in the Valley of the Queens. Now remember, Valley of the Queens is a little bit of a misnomer. It's what the guides call it today. It's what it's called. But it wasn't just queens. It was princes also. And two of his children that he buries there are Amenher-Khepshef and Chaim-Wasit. Now, those names should sound familiar. Those are the names of two of the great children of Ramses the Great, right? Remember, Amenher-Khepshef was the firstborn son who may have died during the Exodus. Chaim-Wasit was the overachieving archaeologist high priest of Memphis. So he's naming his kids even after the kids of Ramses the Great. He wants this association. And to some extent, it works. He is a great king. He is. So he buries his kids there. But during his reign, we have something that's really unique in Egyptian history. There is a plot to kill him. It's called the Harem Conspiracy. And one of the queens plotted to kill her husband by magic. Now, how do we know about such a thing? Ramses isn't going to put this on his temple wall. We have a papyrus that is, in a sense, a stenographer's transcript. It is a court record of what happened. The conspirators, nearly two dozen of them, were tried. Right? And we have a little bit of the details of how do you kill a pharaoh by black magic. Well, first, it involved a queen, as I say. And she was plotting to kill Ramses because she wanted her son to become pharaoh. And this is not that unusual that queens wanted their kids to become the next pharaoh, and maybe if the pharaoh is dead now, mine can move in quickly now. So she's plotting. And it involved priests of the temple. Now, why priests? They had the books of magic. They were the ones who knew how to do this by magic. So we have priests involved. We have palace guards involved. We have the queen involved. It's called the Harem Conspiracy. Now, we know that they were convicted. What is the penalty? Well, in Egypt there were various penalties. Jail, incarceration, is a fairly modern concept. The ancient world didn't throw people in jail for doing bad things. It didn't make sense. Somebody does something bad, so you put them somewhere and you support them. Why do that? It's sort of a strain on your resources. Rather, punish them in a way that it's over with. Boom, finished. Now, for example, in Egypt, if it was a not too heinous crime, you could cut off ears or a nose. And that way, not only would you have punished them, but everybody would know, watch out for this guy, he's a crook. If it was a really serious crime, you would execute him. And the Egyptians executed by impaling someone on a stake, right? Not a nice way to go. So these harem conspirators, right, had a variety. Some had probably ears cut off, noses cut off, but some were certainly executed. As far as we can tell from the record, now the record is damaged, Ramses III died before the trial was over. Now, I'm not suggesting it's from black magic that he dies from the magic, but he dies before the trial was over, and the people are probably executed after he dies, right? He is buried in the Valley of the Kings. Now, his tomb is rather unusual. Pharaohs always had religious scenes on the walls of their tombs. They never had these daily life scenes. You know when you look in the Egyptian art books and you see people in the fields plowing, you see people fishing and hunting? Those are not the tombs of the kings. No. Those are the tombs of the nobles. They wanted to show the gods what they liked in the next world so it would be continued in the next. Right? What they liked in this world so it would be continued in the next. Kings had to put religious texts on their walls. Right? Now there's one unusual thing about Ramses III's tomb. One, there's a secular scene. He apparently was a music lover. And in a side chapel, it shows two harpers playing the harp, right? They're playing the harp, and they're blind. Very often in Egypt, harpers were shown as blind. The idea was that blind people are perhaps more sensitive to sound, so they went into music. So we have this scene of two harpers who are blind. And this is a tomb that was seen by a guy named Bruce, who was looking for the source of the Nile in the early part of the 19th century. He came into this tomb, he saw the harpers, and he told the world about it, and it became known as Bruce's tomb. To this day, some people say, oh, it's Bruce's tomb. Other people, who don't know it's Ramses III, call it the tomb of the two harpers. Right? So Ramses III is buried in this tomb. His mummy, by the way, a little bit of Egyptological trivia, his mummy was found in the Deir al-Bahari cache. And if you look closely at the mummy, it'll look familiar to you. Why? Many of the mummy movies, they pattern the mummy after Ramses III. And I'll tell you a little detail you can look for. Not the Boris Karloff movie, the famous Boris Karloff movie, the 1932 or 33 movie. That's not Ramses III. But after that movie, there were quite a few sequels, because Universal Studios did so well with it, that they brought out three more movies, The Mummy's Tomb, The Mummy's Curse, The Mummy's Hand. And they were patterning after Ramses III. Now, the mummy had been damaged by tomb robbers. And when it was refurbished in ancient times, the head had come off of the body. So they put a stick kind of where the neck is, put it back on, but they wrapped a big bandage around it to cover that the neck was damaged. And that, if you look at the mummy movies, the mummy always has this big kind of, it looks like a scarf almost around his neck. That's because Ramses III's mummy was damaged. But that's Ramses III's mummy. A little bit of Egyptological trivia for you. Now, Ramses III leaves us with a little bit of a mystery. Rules for about 30 years. But if you look at his temple, Medinahabu, united with eternity, where all his great deeds are written on the wall, and there's a wonderful, long, long list of the dedications of things he gave to the temple. Fantastic. I mean, it goes for 150 feet. Just list after list of oils and gold and this and that. But if you look carefully and read what's on the temple walls, it only tells about the first 11 years of his reign. There is nothing about the last two decades that he ruled for. That may be a sign that things were starting to go downhill. Think about it. There was a plot to kill him. He couldn't have been that secure on his throne. So it looks like even during the time of Ramses the Great, Ramses III, things are slipping away. I mean, it could be that Egypt is going downhill already. He is succeeded by three sons of his, all named Ramses. Now, everybody in this dynasty from now on is going to be named Ramses. But remember, there's no relation to Ramses the Great. They're just calling themselves Ramses. The three sons, you've got Ramses IV. Now, he rules for about 6 years. And the good thing, the sign that there's still a little bit of wealth left, a little bit of power, he sends an expedition to the Wadi Hammamat. Now, the Wadi Hammamat is a long march from Thebes towards the Red Sea, across a desert. It requires organization. You've got to dig wells. Why does he send an expedition there? Black granite is there. He wants the black stones for sarcophagi, for buildings, for temples. And it's hard. But he sends an expedition. So at least there's a sign there's still stability. Things may be slipping away, but there's some stability. And if you go to the Wadi Hammamat, and tourists hardly ever go there, because there's no reason except go to where the black granite is. Fantastic inscriptions on the rocks. Fantastic. These expeditions were sometimes a couple of thousand men. And they knew how to quarry stone. These guys were stone workers. So very often, they wanted to pray. They were religious people, but they didn't have a temple there. So right on the rock, they would carve a statue of their god. And some of them are beautiful. And they would list all the men of the expedition. Under the vizier so-and-so, we came, we quarried so much stone, and they could go there and pray every day when they were finished with their work. So it's rather beautiful. It's in the middle of the desert, and you're just driving along this desert road. It used to be the old caravan route. Nobody takes it anymore. And then all of a sudden, you come in this valley, you got black stones on either side, and they're all inscribed with beautiful hieroglyphs. It's really spectacular. So at least a son of Ramses III is able to send an expedition to the Wadi Hammamat. The other son, Ramses V, he's a legitimate succession, but we don't know much about him. I'll tell you the one interesting thing about his mummy, though. He has spots on his face. We're pretty sure he had smallpox. Earliest case of smallpox recorded. But Ramses V had smallpox. And Ramses VI, the other son of Ramses III, doesn't reign too long, but we do know one thing. Egypt is starting to slip out from under him. Foreign territories are lost. They no longer send mining expeditions into the Sinai for turquoise. They don't have the power. The army isn't there. Something is happening. During the next one, Ramses VII, there's an economic turmoil. Prices soar. Inflation. They had inflation just like we do, and it soared. Ramses VIII, we hardly know anything about. Hardly anything. Now, Ramses IX, he has a pretty long reign, but the only thing we know really for his dynasty, there were tomb robbers. This is when the royal tombs are robbed. This is when we start to get real robbing of the Valley of the Kings. And think of what that means. They could no longer protect the valley. I mean, this is where you do have the body of Ramses the Great. The body of Ramses the Third, if you like. The body of all of these great kings. And they're being plundered. And how do I know that it's during his reign? We have some court records. We have some court records. I'll give you an idea of what they said. They took sort of what we would call depositions, right? They're records. This is during the reign of Ramses. They got the thieves. They caught him. And this is what one of them saying. We found the burial place of the royal wife, his royal wife. We forced it open. We opened their outer coffins, their inner coffins in which they lay. We found this noble mummy of this king equipped like a warrior. A large number of sacred eye amulets and ornaments of gold was at his neck. And his headpiece of gold was on him. So the thieves found this royal tomb intact. The noble mummy of this king was all covered with gold. And his inner coffins were bedrizened with gold and silver, inside and outside, with inlays of all kinds of precious stones. We appropriated the gold which we found on this noble mummy of this god, and on his eye amulets, his ornaments which were at his neck, and in the coffins in which he lay. We found the royal wife, likewise, and we took all that we found on her too. We set fire to their inner coffins. We stole their outfit, which we found on them, consisting of objects of gold, silver, bronze, and divided them up among ourselves. We made this gold, which we found on these two gods, into eight parts. So there were probably eight robbers, right? It was a concerted effort altogether. And they took the gold. But they were caught. They were caught. But this happens during the reign of Ramses the Ninth. So we know that Egypt is really going downhill rather quickly. I mean, it's a... It's a sad story to see Egypt go down from the time of, you know, greatness to where the mummies are just being robbed. But anyway, Ramses X is another mummy. Is another pharaoh. Unimportant. All we know is that all foreign territories are lost during his reign. But now we come to the last king of the dynasty, Ramses XI. And we get a few strange things during his reign. First, we have a papyrus from his time, which was originally thought to be more literary than historic, but it's probably historical. It's called The Tale of Wenamun. Now, Wenamun was an official, and he was sent to Byblos to bring back wood, cedar. Now, why is he going to bring back cedar of Lebanon? Well, first of all, you need it for the pharaoh's ships. That's important because there's no forests in Egypt. You're not going to get timber out of Egypt. But also, remember I told you last time about those royal barks, the shrines where the statues were put on and carried that looked like boats? You need it for that, and you need doors for the temples, big doors. So Wenamun is sent. This is during the reign of the last king of this dynasty. And what happens to Wenamun? First of all, he's robbed along the way. The king's ambassador is robbed. Never would have happened during a time of greatness. Never. So then he arrives at Byblos. And what does he say to this prince of Byblos that he has to go before? He says, well, give me the cedar of Lebanon anyway. I have a statue of Amun. By the way, he took a statue of Amun with him, who is called Amun of the Road. It's the equivalent of our Saint Christopher, right? The patron saint of travelers. He has a little Amun of the Road, you know? And he has the statue with him, and he says to the prince, you know, I brought you Amun. And the prince says, thanks a lot, but where's the money? And, you know, when Amun is trying to be eloquent, he says, you know, our pharaohs have done business with you for many, many generations. And he says, yeah, you're right. But they always paid. You know, where is the money? Wenamun is in a tight spot. He really is. Eventually, somehow he talks the prince of Byblos into giving him the wood, the cedars. Probably the king sends money, you know, eventually. But he waited for almost a year. You know, he's waiting there for months and months and months, and finally the cedars are felled. They wait by the river till be loaded on ships. And finally he returns. But one of the things that is curious about this document, we're certain that he sent during the reign of Ramses XI. But he doesn't talk about Ramses XI. He talks about another guy, Herihor. And this is something that happens during the reign of Ramses XI that is shocking. Never in the time of a pharaoh did this happen. A high priest of Amun, by the name of Herihor, builds his own temple at Karnak Temple, dedicated to Khonsu, the son of Amun Mut, right? And shows himself on the temple as large as the king. As large as the king. Not only that, a little later on in the reign, year 24 of Ramses, he writes his name in a cartouche. This high priest of Amun writes his name in a cartouche which symbolizes the king's power. We have the high priest of Amun claiming that he is the king of Egypt. Now, how is this possible? Well, remember, Ramses XI is ruling in the north, out of the capital in the north. Things are slipping away. He may have all he can handle in the north. So Herihor, this high priest, calls himself king. And we end this dynasty with two people writing their names in cartouches, Ramses XI and Herihor. But Herihor adds one little thing to his name. Repetition of births. What he's saying is, there's going to be a renaissance under me. Things are going to get better. And we'll talk about that next time. See you then.